Natalia sat on the couch. Her face was still tender where it was bruised. She moved her body slowly to get a more comfortable position. The welts on her back made it awkward to sit. She rearranged the long robe around her as she tucked her legs up onto the sofa and hugged her knees to her. Karamazov, she thought. Vladimir. Would her uncle try to get revenge against Vladimir? The thought chilled her more than ice. She brushed a strand of black hair off her forehead and wrapped the blue terry cloth robe around her more tightly. She glanced at the digital clock on the table beside the sofa. Her uncle, General Ishmael Varakov, had called 25 minutes before to tell her he was coming to see her. Why? She stood up, tightened the belt around the robe, and reached into the small drawer of the end table. She had put away the gun she'd taken from Vladimir and had the little four-barreled stainless steel COP pistol. She broke the pistol, verified all four barrels were loaded, and dropped the double-action-only Derringer-like gun in the right pocket of her robe. Her hand remained there as she moved toward the recently repaired door. It was likely her uncle, she thought, but chances were something only fools took.
Yes, who is at the door?
It is cold out here, and I'm an old man too lazy to button his coat. Hurry, girl!
The old man stood there, his greatcoat open as he'd told her, rubbing his gloved hands together.
Uncle.
Child.
They stopped at the end of the hall beside the steps leading down into the living room. She helped him out of his coat, took his hat and gloves, and watched him as he walked into the living room. Hugging the coat to her, she walked back into the hall and hung it on the coat tree and set the hat on a small table. Afraid of what her uncle would say, she walked hesitantly back toward the living room. Natalia sat beside him on the couch, tucking her knees up and her ankles under her again, looking at his deep, almost canine sad eyes.
Natalia, I need information, and I will not tell you why. You doubtless already suspect why, at any event, child. You may keep your suspicions. I want information.
What do you want to know, Uncle?
I want to know the name of the man Vladimir had in Samuel Chambers' inner circle, the traitor to the new president. I want the man's name, his title, or official duties, and how he may be contacted. I want this all now.
Sarah Rourke sat on the porch swing, watching the reddish orb of sun in the low and thin clouds. This was a peaceful universe for her, or perhaps she thought an island of normalcy in the fear and hatred and terror of the world since the war. She stood up, her feet in borrowed shoes, smoothed the borrowed dress against her as she walked into the house through the screen door and through the perfectly normal living room or parlor, past the long dining room table, already set, and through the narrow hall past the pantry into the kitchen. She liked older houses, despite the sometimes awkward room arrangements.
Can I help with dinner, Mary?
No need, Sarah, but you can if you like. I need those potatoes peeled, knife over in the top drawer, and there's an apron on the hook on the other side of the door.
Okay. What do I put the peelings in?
I'd say open a newspaper. We used to use an old newspaper, but there ain't none. We used to use a grocery sack. Old Mr. Harlan ran the grocery, but he died of a heart attack when they busted into the grocery. Drove their trucks and motorcycles right through the glass windows, they did. Killed some of the clerks who were trying to help old Mr. Harland. I don't know, Sarah, where to put them peels from them potatoes. I don't know.
Rourke was going on a commando raid, he guessed. Something against a Soviet installation in the city somewhere near. He had left the bike for two of Reed's men to guard, as well as Reed's other equipment. Then, with Reed and the other two surviving team members, Rourke had made his way through the woods and paralleled the road for about a mile, seeing no sign of traffic as they reached the old drive-in theater. Rourke knew the man and woman who'd owned it years before, and now, as he turned off the road and skirted behind it, avoiding the access drive, he wondered if somehow the couple had managed to make it through the Holocaust.
Why are we taking the long way around, Rourke?
I trust the motives of the resistance people, but there could always be a ringer in with them, working for the Soviets.
Goddamn Russians.
Yeah, well, maybe goddamn communists, but not goddamn Russians. They're people just like we are, led by their government, doing what they're told.
You were sweet on that Russian broad a little, weren't you? Chambers said
you keep out of my personal affairs, Reed, you hear that? And not that it's any of your business, because it damn well isn't. But if it weren't for that Russian broad, your president would have been locked away by the communist occupation forces by now. And you and all your people would have been croaked in a neutron blast. Doesn't matter how I feel about her. She did us a good turn and got her own tail in a sling probably doing it. And I wouldn't be here doing this foolishness to begin with if I weren't trying to find my wife and kids. You grow up a little. Maybe you're gonna realize that any normal man meets a lot of broads, like you call them, a lot of women he can like. Maybe he could love under different circumstances. But it's only juvenile delinquents and morons who figure fidelity is a one-way street. I figure if my wife counts me as alive, wherever she is, she's being faithful to me. And I don't just owe her the same. I want to give her the same. Now, you think you got all that, Reed? Or you want to go back out there a few hundred yards into the brush and get the shit kicked out of you?
You give sermons too, huh? Mr. Good Guy, Mr. Hero. What's some dinky-ass nuclear war to you, huh?
You and the guys like you who stayed with the system are the ones who fucked it all up. You had to play your little games, do your little dances, keep the world spinning around, and figure when it stopped, it was like a roulette wheel. You win, fine. You lose, well, there's always another game. Well, you look at the sunsets. You feel the temperatures against your skin. You measure the rainfall. Count the dead bodies, sucker. Some communist gave an attack order. Some guy over here gave an attack order. And it's just real great to push some goddamn anonymous button, huh? You go out and kill a couple hundred million people some night when you can smell their sweat. Smell it when they die and their bowels loosen up and their sphincters relax. And you can see the eyes go glassy. You do it that way next time and see how well you like playing.
Rourke turned around and started through the brush toward the main parking area of the abandoned drive-in, somehow feeling better inside and at the same time feeling worse. He'd always labeled himself either laid back or uptight. He'd never been sure which. And he wasn't used to hearing himself let go. His jaw set, he kept walking. Rourke edged toward the farthest end of the tall standing pine trees, their bare shadows casting long, thin lines along the ground from the reflected light of Coleman lanterns in the center of the drive-in lot. Rourke watched the assembled men. No women. He didn't like the rendezvous. It was too open. He waited as the now silent Reed edged up near him.
After this is through, Rourke, it's you and me.
Rourke simply nodded. Reed, competent, tough, and Rourke thought, about as bullheaded as he, was the last thing on his mind. General Varakov sat in darkness. Other than the light from the long rectangular lamp that bathed his desk in yellow, beyond was shadow, and then beyond it, blackness. And far into the main hall, near the skeletons of the mastodons, was a ceiling light, but it shone more like a beacon than a source of illumination. The light cast shadows from the bones of the two prehistoric giants and seemed only to accentuate how they somehow did not fit in the real world of men and yet emphasized the mortality the two species shared. Varakov wiped his hands across his eyes and stared at the file folder. It was the KGB file on John Thomas Rourke. Doctor of medicine with no particular specialty, and training toward general practice. And, after the degree, internship at... Varakov didn't recognize the name of the hospital. After, there was an unaccounted-for year, and then Rourke had joined Central Intelligence as a case officer. The translation for what Varakov knew was a spy, an agent. He had moved into the black section, covert operations, and had killed several times for the agency, targets usually in Latin America. Varakov noted with interest that apparently Karamazov and Rourke had crossed paths in Latin America once, and Rourke had bested Karamazov. For some reason not clear in the file, Rourke had quit Central Intelligence after an affair in Latin America, which he'd barely survived. There had been an ambush, Rourke's people had been killed, and only Rourke's body had not been found. And then several weeks later, a man matching Rourke's general description had been seen near the docks, and after that, Rourke had apparently drifted into Miami, barely alive. His nerve gone? Varakov doubted that. For after leaving the CIA, Rourke had begun to freelance, not in intelligence, but in counter-terrorist training, survival training, weapons skills, etc. He had been spotted working with pro-American military and police units in virtually every corner of the world where the Americans needed the help most. Varakov made a mental note to see if Rourke had really left the company, as it was called, or simply assumed a cover. Rourke had written several books on the medical, psychological, and weapons-related aspects of survival, short and long-term. He was an expert. Varakov noted with curiosity that some of Rourke's works had been pirated, translated, and were adapted as training manuals in the Soviet Union. The thought amused him. He wondered if Rourke would take such knowledge well. He doubted it. He scanned through the family background. Wife works as an artist, illustrator, and writer of children's books. Two children, Michael and Anne. Varakov worked the dates. The boy would be 9, the girl 6. He scanned through the file to the skills section. There was a repeat of the medical background, the standard things one expected in an intelligence agent or former agent dealing with radio, etc. He was qualified on helicopters, fixed-wing aircraft, military jets. Rourke's Georgia driver's license number appeared there. Curiously, Varakov thought, the same as Rourke's social security number. He was reportedly an expert marksman, but that was to be expected. Habitually carried 45 ACP or 357 Magnum caliber handguns. Perfect. He'd liked the sound of the man when he'd spoken with him and realized that despite their political, ideological, and other differences, to Varakov's thinking, they were much alike. Men of purpose, men with feeling, men who did what they must. Varakov had never liked Karamazov, who had no feeling, and when the surface was finally scratched, the insides were worse than those of a pig. Natalia was his special child, and for hurting her, Karamazov would simply and finally die. Varakov did not consider it revenge, and the justice of it was not something that bothered him either. It was just, but more to the point, it was something he wanted done. He sighed, not being a vindictive man, but wishing that circumstance did not preclude him pulling the trigger himself.
Varakov here.
Hello, yes, Varakov.
So, at last. You too are a general of sorts, I hear.
Yes, sir.
Randon Soames, commander of the paramilitary forces of Texas, one of Samuel Chambers' trusted confidants. A man who visited Russia 12 years ago, who's been working for us ever since, and has before the war handed us over numerous copies of secret files coming through your electronics components businesses. How nice to meet you.
Yes, sir.
I understand that you sexually molested a child.
Sir, please, I beg you not to mention that again.
I personally would not have chosen blackmailing you into espionage, for I hate traitors. I would have shot you. You are worse than a savage, worse than an animal. I would have no compunction against leaking to your American friends who you are, what you have done for us, and why. That is clear?
But, General Varakov...
You will do exactly as I say. I am a man of honor, and you are not. Therefore, you are taking advantage of me, and you have nothing to lose. I need the following. I understand this American terrorist, Rourke. He is obsessed with locating his wife and children, who were living in Georgia before the war. All indications would be that he has gone there. How can he be found? Immediately.
But, sir, I have...
You will find him for me. Tell me how he can be located precisely, and all will be as it was. If you do not, then all will be bad for you. I will hear from you in 2 hours. You would have more time had you contacted me sooner as requested.
But, sir, I had to be so careful so no one...
I am not interested in these concerns, however genuine. Just do your part of the job and get the information I demand. A team led by a Captain Reed will finish your dirty work, and you will be left alone. That is my pledge.
But, sir, Captain Reed has already reported his position. I already have the information.
Ah, very good.
He's in Athens, Georgia, on a raid of some kind.
Soames, I will pass you off to my lieutenant, and you will tell him everything you know. You have done satisfactorily. You are safe.
Thank you, sir.
But... if it ever comes to me that you touch another child, I will come after you and kill you myself with my bare hands.
Yes, Comrade General?
Elena, contact immediately the commander of the Southeast Regional District and get him on my line. Have my personal plane fueled and ready. Pack a bag for me. I have business to attend to outside of Chicago immediately.
We got committees of resistance forming in Tennessee, Alabama, Pennsylvania, both Carolinas. We'll alert them all to keep their eyes peeled for your woman and kids. That's a promise. Don't think we can't sympathize with y'all, because we can. And don't y'all think we don't appreciate it here. I mean, you and these other fellas helping us go up against them Reds? Tough stuff, huh?
What about Colfax?
I got that info. But something tells me that I'm gonna leave that information on where he's hanging out till after tonight. You never know what might happen.
All right. Where's the raid gonna be, and on what? What kind of resistance can we expect? How do we get there? You know, all that standard movie stuff, huh?
Rourke remembered having met Abner Folsom once some years back at the hardware store he'd run in Athens. The Committee of Resistance was some 20 men strong, at least this night, and their weapons ranged from the sublime to the ridiculous, with everything in between. There were lever-action 30-30 Winchesters, bolt-action rifles of various persuasions, Colt, FN, and Heckler & Koch assault-type rifles, and one or two sawn-back pump shotguns. The handguns ranged from single-action Ruger Super Blackhawks in cowboy-style holsters to Walther PPK S-380s to 45s to almost every imaginable Colt or Smith & Wesson revolver variant. One man had a MAC-10. He'd been a submachine gun collector before the war and had loaned or given away much of his collection to the Resistance. Unfortunately, Rourke thought, the people who had most of the selective fire weapons were somewhere else at the present. Darren Ball had been strangely silent, sitting with an AR-15 across his lap and a government Model 45 in a military type across-the-chest shoulder holster. Rourke thought Ball's silence wouldn't last for long.
There was a huge modern shopping center not too far from the city, real popular place before the war. Russian occupation forces are using it now as a supply depot and helicopter base because of the big parking lot. Some of us blew up the airport when we learned the Russians were coming in, so they've been using the shopping center. There's a big ammo dump there, too. Figure we can steal all the AK-47s and such we can carry and ammo for them, blow up everything else. We go to the shopping center, got a code name for it, Firehole.
Anything else?
Yeah. We know a secret way into the place, too, through a big storm drain. It's still operational, but there hasn't been no big storm lately, so the drain should be pretty dry, I figure.
That's all.
Yeah, about it. Why?
Well...
What he means is a commando-style raid against a hard military site, like a supply depot isn't something you whip up on the spur of the moment, Folsom. Same thing I've been trying to tell you for a long time. That's why the last raid got you so many casualties.
There was a last raid, Ball?
These damn fools. All they decided to go and dynamite the guard posts in the center of town. Blew up one part of the installation, killed maybe a half dozen Russian soldiers, and lost five of their own men.
How many men you have, Folsom?
We got about...
You ever use women?
Well, we always figured the women wasn't really good.
Women do just as well in resistance work as men. Some of them are more savage fighters than a man could ever be. You're cutting down your personnel pool by more than half that way. Women can get in places innocently where men can't. The whole thing. What explosives are you using for this raid?
Well, we got a little dynamite. Figured to steal our explosives on the spot and take some extras along.
What if they're fresh out of explosives? What if they don't keep detonation devices anywhere nearby? What if... It's a whole bunch of what ifs. This isn't a raid, it's a mass suicide. Count me out.
Mr. Rourke?
What?
We need a raid like this. We need to show the Russians we can strike back and strike back hard. I got some dynamite. Maybe we can rig something, maybe...
hell.
Sarah turned from watching the moon on the porch steps and looked at the boy, Thad, Mary's son. 16, she guessed, give or take a year. Sarah turned and stared back at the moon, hugging her knees up to her, swatting at a mosquito against her bare calf and pulling her dress down lower over her legs.
I'm going with Pa to join up with the Resistance, and that's a plain fact.
Thad, don't you think your mother needs a man around the house? Your father, your brothers, they're all in the Resistance.
Sarah's right, boy. We need a man around here.
Them Russians is building a big fort or base near where Chattanooga used to be.
Chattanooga's still there, Thad, but all the people are dead. I don't think you'd want to see Chattanooga. There was just death everywhere. You wouldn't want to see Chattanooga, Thad. Trust me.
That's a big base the Russians has got. Gotta stop them before they get so all set up and everything, they can't get stopped, you know?
The boy wanted reassurance, Sarah thought. Men so often, at least some men, insisted women were so alike. Men were sometimes alike, too, and she almost envied it. If John, her husband, were still alive, she wanted him to be. Whatever John was doing now, he was consumed with it, she was sure. He was searching for her, searching for the children, fighting communist soldiers and perhaps brigands, very likely. Men found toys for their minds, even under the worst circumstances, just from their role of being men. There was always something to do, to go up against. She leaned against the post beside the porch railing and stared out across the dark expanse of the fields. Thad and her husband, John, their thing to do now was go and fight. All she could do was wait, care for the children, keep the home, clean the wounds, and go quietly insane each time she thought of John risking his life. She stared up at the peculiar haze around the moon, wishing he were there to tell her what it all meant. Was the world ending? The heat, the cold, the torrential rains, the red sunsets?
Mary? Mary, I'm going to leave in a few days, because if I don't, I won't have the strength to do anything but stay here.
Colonel Vasily Korsinsky walked from his desk to the small mirror inside the open closet door, then smoothed his white hair with his hands and studied his face. Classic, he thought, chiseled. He couldn't help but smile. He was pleased that Varakov trusted him so.
Sir!
This is Colonel Korsinsky. Alert the counter-terrorist force to move out within 5 minutes.
Korsinsky walked back to the closeted mirror and took his cap, adjusting it at a slight angle over his left eye, smoothing back the white hair, smoothing his uniform jacket under the gun belt, opening the flap holster. Glancing once more into the mirror, he closed the closet door and started across his office toward the door. Korsinsky strode purposefully, he was conscious of himself as always, down the hallway. Narcissism, some called it that. He called it pride and realization of his destiny. He turned the corner into the side corridor, the glassed wall on one side, looking out into the central square where the counter-terrorist force was already forming. He walked along the hallway, staring into the glass, seeing his own image half-reflected and superimposed on the glass over the figures of running, armed men, motorcycle units, and troop vehicles. Korsinsky surveyed the men assembling around him, the officers saluting as he passed. He returned their salutes with a studied casualness. He could see his aide running up to him, carrying his greatcoat and his swagger stick. He stopped, letting the man hold the coat for him. Korsinsky left the collar up, the coat hanging open, the swagger stick under his left arm, as he pulled the skin-tight leather gloves over his manicured fingers. He glanced with great drama at the watch on his wrist. It was only minutes, and the men were already assembled. Most of the men had boarded into the trucks, and the motorcycle patrols were mounted. His staff car waited ahead.
Men! We have been notified of a full-scale terrorist assault to be conducted at a location not far from here. We are to contain the terrorists until their ammunition is exhausted, then to take them in hand-to-hand combat and preserve as many of their lives as possible. There is one man. He is tall. His hair is dark, rising from a high forehead. He frequently wears sunglasses, even at night. He will be wearing several handguns and be skilled in their use. No one man is to attempt to take him. Squad action only. If any man kills this man, he will himself be shot. This man, at all costs, must be taken alive and as uninjured as possible. I can explain no further for reasons of security. We will move out toward the helicopter staging area and supply depot. We toil for the liberation of the workers of the world, and for this reason, we ourselves are invincible!
Colonel Korsinsky had always admired the incantation the Nazis had used. Spirit was important. He saluted the swagger stick against the peak of his hat and strode off towards his men, his staff car, and his destiny. Rourke stared at the moon and the curious ghost-like haze around it, shuddering slightly. The night was cold, The air here on the river was damp and chill, but the shudder was for some other reason he couldn't quite define. He glanced skyward at the haloed moon. The shudder came again. The water of the river licked up against the hull of Rourke's rubber boat as it glided through the darkness alongside three more just like it. The crafts stayed towards the middle of the river, searching the blackness and shadows on the right bank for the outlet of the storm drain. In the darkness, he felt the safety on the CAR-15, checked the security of the twin stainless Detonix pistols in their shoulder holsters, checked the security of the flap on the Ranger rig holding the metallified Government 45 on his hip. He was nervous. The mission held something that smelled bad to him, tasted foul. There was something very wrong with it, and it wasn't just the poor planning or the inexperienced people. He half wished Paul Rubinstein had been well enough to come along. At least he trusted Paul, and for what Paul lacked in experience, he compensated well in intelligence and initiative. Rourke pulled up the collar of his leather jacket. He snatched off the sunglasses, securing them in his shirt pocket, squinting as his eyes adjusted to the difference in light. He almost laughed aloud. If he hadn't been so sensitive to light all through his life, he would have thought it symptomatic of radiation sickness. He checked the closure on the canvas musette bag hanging from his left side over the M16 bayonet, and the closure on the Bushnell armored 8x30s hanging from his right side. The bottoms of his jeans were rolled in with blousing garters over the tops of his combat boots. Stuffing the pants in the boots had always been uncomfortable to him. He remembered once, years earlier, having fought his way 5 miles in sub-freezing temperatures through more than 2 feet of fresh snow on foot. The drifts had been as high as his thighs, and he had fallen several times. Then the pants had been tucked into the boots to keep the snow out. He had made it then, and he thought that somehow he'd make it tonight. He had to. He had come to think of it as a quest, no less important than a search for the Grail, for any treasure, ancient or modern. More important, even, because it was a human quest to find the 3 surviving humans who meant the most to him in all the world. The woman he had always loved, the son, the daughter. Each child, part of him and part of her.
Over there, past those rocks and weeds.
Rourke, his night vision better than most because of light sensitivity, could see the outline of the upper right quarter of the storm drain's circular entrance clearly. Rats, snakes, wolf spiders, possibly. He set his jaw, staring at the entrance as 2 of Reed's men, doing the rowing on Rourke's boat, changed course from the center of the river toward the marshy, muddy bank. As the rubber boat skidded into the mud, Rourke rose to his feet. He approached the storm drain entrance, Reed beside him and Folsom behind Reed.
What the hell is that?
It's a spider nest. See him in trees and branches a lot.
Hell, I'll get it.
No, if it were blocking the entrance, fine. If it were in our way, fine. Never kill anything unless you have to. There's enough things you have to kill these days already.
Rourke sidestepped in front of Reed. He took out his Zippo and flicked it open. He glanced at the luminous face of the Rolex on his wrist in the light of the flame, then moved the blue-yellow fire toward the entrance, up and down and from side to side, inspecting the tunnel beyond the lip of the storm drain.
What do you think, Mr. Rourke?
My first name is John. What do I think about the storm drain? Maybe a nice place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there.
Rourke closed the Zippo and reached into his belt under his leather jacket, snatching the Safariland Kell light. As the light filled the storm drain, he could see it glinting on what looked to him like eyes beyond the light and in the shadow ahead.
What the hell is that squeaking?
Bats, I think.
Bats?
They're small. They're not the vampire kind. If you were Peach or a Pear, you'd be in trouble.
That's a relief.
Yeah, just don't let them scratch you or bite. They carry rabies sometimes.
Rourke started forward, hearing the shuffling of feet behind him from the rest of the 16-man commando force. 2 of Reed's men and some of Folsom's, including Darren Ball, were waiting with the boats.
Bats! God, bet you they're snakes, too.
Most poisonous snakes won't kill you. They'll just make you damn sick, unless you have a reaction to the venom.
Rourke flashed his light ahead across the reddish-brown mud, swatting at cobwebs with his free right hand, the CAR-15 slung across his back, muzzle down. The storm drain was about 6 feet in diameter, and there was a simple choice, Rourke decided. Either walk through the deepest and slipperiest of the mud and duck your head a little, or walk to the side on angle and move half-stooped. He chose the muddy water and mire. Shuffling along through the storm drain, with his flashlight and two others at intervals along the 17-man single-file column, the only illumination, Rourke paced himself, trying to judge the distance, not trusting wholly what Folsom had described as a mile's walk. The tunnel the drain formed took a slight bend along an elbow of pipe, then curved at a right angle, then started slightly upward. They moved on, roaches everywhere on the floor of the drain near the edge of the mire, feeding on the bat droppings, perhaps.
Man, I'm a little claustrophobic. The place gives me the creeps.
I don't think anybody exactly likes it. I make it we've gone a pretty good distance. No end of the tunnel is in sight. How much further?
My brother laid the train, told me about it. Said it was just about an even mile.
And it lets out in a small culvert at the edge of a parking lot, then dips back under the lot toward the shopping center itself?
That's what he said.
Where's your brother now?
Dead. He was in Atlanta when the bombs or missiles or whatever hit it.
I'm sorry, Abner. Back flat against the wall. Everyone. There's something up ahead. Maybe the end of the line. I'll check it out. You all stay here.
There was light, dim, but light nonetheless, up ahead, and Rourke moved toward it. The smell in the drain had been bad, but here it was worse, the drain partially clogged and the water several inches deep. He edged up along the side and stooped as he went forward, grateful for the insect repellent he had used. There were swarms of small flies and mosquitoes, some of them, he wagered with himself, carrying sleeping sickness. The tunnel took a slight bend around a right-angle elbow joint, and Rourke stopped again at the mouth of the tunnel, a heavy-looking grillwork over the drain opening beyond, and a V-shaped cement culvert visible in the moonlight ahead. Rourke peered out beyond the grating into the open, smelling the comparatively fresh night air. It was set into the mouth of the drain, forming a grid of squares 8 inches roughly on each side, a thin layer of cement holding it in place. A slightly wider opening at the top and bottom and each side where the grid of steel didn't quite fit. An afterthought, he guessed. He edged back. He stopped where Reed, Folsom, and the others crouched along the side of the drain beyond the elbow.
I need a couple of bayonets and a couple of good-sized rocks. Gonna have to hammer our way out.
Why don't you use that bayonet you got?
Because I paid for mine and yours is issue. Well, use yours. Now let's get going. Time's against us. It's almost midnight. We haven't even penetrated the base yet. Come on.
With the intelligence captain behind him, Rourke started forward again toward the elbow, through it, and then slowly toward the grating at the end of the storm drain.
Watch your eyes for chips, Reed. Cheap construction. Okay. Just that one more side there. I'm gonna try and pull it down as you chip away.
Tough guy.
Yeah, just start working. Okay, help me bring it down. Reed, go back there and get the rest of them. I'm gonna scope things from here for a minute.
All right.
Rourke shimmied out of the storm drain, up the side of the channel, and peered over the edge of the culvert and across. The parking lot was comparatively huge for a largely rural area, the yellow lines drawn for orderly parking meaningless now. A few rusted wrecks sat in the lot at the far side, but that was all. Closer in, toward the shopping center itself, Rourke could see Soviet-marked trucks, the red stars seeming to burn in the night somehow. Psychological, he imagined.
What's up?
You've been around, Reed. This whole deal smells. We're not going in the rest of the way through the storm drain. We're cutting across this lot and into the buildings. There's a trap out there. Only thing we can do is try and work around it.
Folsom's not gonna like that.
Yeah, well, that's too damn bad. I'll let him lead the war when he lets me sell hardware. Come on. Folsom.
What's going on, Rock? You see anything?
There's some kind of trap in the wind. I can feel it. We're going through the parking lot to the buildings. Couple of us go up on the roofs after sentries, then everybody piles after us. If it looks possible, some of us can go into the complex through the roof.
Why not the drain, the way we
had... Look, you want to go that route? Count me out.
Okay, you're the expert.
All right, you keep a handle on things here. I'll take Reed and his two Army intelligence guys with me. Reed, get your two boys and stay with me. We're crossing the lot.
Korsinsky surveyed the ruddy-cheeked officer standing in attention beside the open door leading to the back seat of his staff car. The colonel could tell how young the man was, even in the slight visibility of the darkened shopping center parking garage.
These are the complete details of your architectural survey, Lieutenant?
Yes, Comrade Colonel.
Excellent. This storm drain that appears here, Lieutenant.
Yes, Comrade Colonel?
You will be commander for this portion of the operation. Do not fail. Take a platoon of men to the outlet of the storm drain, approach with caution, apprehend any persons near or inside the outlet, then proceed up the drain pipe toward the parking square. Any questions?
All is clear, Comrade Colonel.
Excellent. Now get moving, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir.
Captain, I understand that this man Rourke that we seek is highly experienced. He will no doubt become alarmed that there is no visible presence in the parking square or on the rooftops. I doubt he will proceed along the storm drain past this point. This is some sort of opening. You will position men at the far boundary of the parking square in case Rourke and these others decide to withdraw. Otherwise, if you make contact, keep them under direct observation, but do nothing. Maintain radio silence in the event they are tuned to our usual frequencies. The jaws of the trap will close when they enter the complex or if they try to escape. Remember, Captain, take this one Rourke alive. Preserve his weapons. He is not to be harmed.
Comrade Colonel?
I cannot confide this reasoning to you. It is at the highest levels of security. You will just have to trust me as your superior. Now, Captain, has the plane arrived yet from Chicago?
Yes, Comrade Colonel, moments ago.
Very good. The young woman aboard is to be brought here and kept safely away from any of the fighting. She is not to be questioned.
Yes, Comrade Colonel.
Lazily, in a studied movement, Korsinsky returned the captain's salute. He could not tell the captain why this man Rourke was to be taken unharmed, his weapons kept if he wished, for he had not been told himself. Rourke pushed himself up and raced from the lip of the culvert and across the parking lot toward the grassy knoll some 200 yards away, the CAR-15 in his right fist, the safety off, the freshness of the air exhilarating to his lungs, his hair blowing across his face and then back from his forehead in the cool night wind. He hit the grassy knoll and threw himself to the ground, hugging the green as he waited for Reed, then the two men after him. Sighting through the Colt's three-power scope, he tried spotting the roofline. Again, he saw nothing, then edged along the grass closer toward the building. Reed was nearly across the parking area now, one of the other men already starting out from the culvert.
You see anything?
No, nothing.
Rourke stopped, rolling onto his back on the grass, catching his breath, staring up at the night sky and the stars. The haze was still around the moon. He snatched a tuft of grass from beside him. It was green and healthy. He could feel a mist starting to fall, but he couldn't be sure of whether it was radioactive yet or not. There was so little time for him to find Sarah and the children, if there were any time at all. There was safety in the retreat. He stared up as the stars began fading above a thin layer of clouds. What then, he asked himself. What after he found Sarah, Michael, and Anne? Life in the retreat forever? Only going outside specially suited up because the air was foul? What if radiation seeped through the ground into the water source for the retreat somewhere hundreds of miles away? He monitored and tested the water periodically, but what if? The ifs were what gnawed at him, but he had no choice but to find his family, and after that, somehow keep them all alive. Rourke was convinced now that the communists were setting a trap, and what drew him on, he supposed, was the reason behind it. If they wanted the attackers in the commando team dead, they would have opened up already, sealed the storm drain, pot-shotted them through the other side, or gassed them. There were an infinite number of ways to kill. Whatever the trap, it was important enough to risk the supply depot and the helicopter landing field on the other side of the shopping center. Whatever the trap, the mass death of the commando team was not its objective. Rourke's stomach turned, and his palms began to sweat under the gloves he wore.
Okay. Let's move out.
Roger that.
The four men rose to their knees and began edging along toward the rise at the top of the knoll, keeping their heads below it and peering beyond. There was more of the parking area, where Rourke finally saw some signs of life. But not enough, he told himself. There were two fixed-wing aircraft of the single-engine variety, apparently used for observation flights, and with a short enough takeoff that they could use the lot. trucks were parked alongside the buildings, and there were lights from inside through what had once been the windows of the stores when it had still been a shopping center.
I make it about 6 feet to the nearest part of that lower level roof line, 6 feet from the grass. Let's get everybody up and over except Corporal Cooley. Have him wait 5 minutes in case some shooting starts. No sense getting more people killed than we have to.
You heard him, Cooley. Stand by.
Got it, sir.
Rourke didn't wait for a reply, but started moving, running in a low crouch toward the nearest roof line. Setting his safety on and letting the rifle sling back behind his shoulder, upping his speed, raising to his full height as he ran the last few yards, his hands going out ahead of him. His hands clawed for the roof line, then, getting a grip, he swung his body up and over. On his hands and knees, pushing himself up to a crouch, he swung the rifle forward, edging off the safety, making a quick visual inspection of the scope. He ascertained that there was no damage done to his cover. He moved off toward a roof-mounted air conditioner. Going flat against it, he surveyed the roof line, knowing for sure now that it was a trap. He was certain now that there were no guards. He could see men on the next higher roof level, but only a fool of a commander would have left an entire section of the roof line unguarded.
You see anything?
Not enough. Come on.
Rourke ducked from behind the air conditioning unit to the edge of the higher roof line, going into a crouch. Reed joined him.
I'll handle this. Wait here.
Rourke slipped the safety on his CAR-15 and pushed himself up the 6 feet to the next roof line, scrambling over it. He studied the guard nearest him, one man, standing in the open, an obvious setup, he thought. Rourke crawled on his stomach along the roof surface toward the side overlooking the knoll. Peering over the edge, he saw something that, though he expected it, made his blood run cold, a large concentration of troops waiting in the wooded areas beyond the far side of the upper-level parking area. He jogged in a low crouch across the roof line to the far parking areas in the front of the shopping center. Dropping low beside the roof edge, Rourke looked over the side.
Shit!
Soviet armor surrounded the several dozen military helicopters on the ground, motorcycle-mounted troops ringing what looked to be a staff car. Rourke backed up and jogged back toward Reed.
Well?
I'll kiss your plan goodbye. Zero chance of success. Zero chance of survival. We need to get the hell out of here right now.
Rourke took off back towards the edge closest to the knoll. The corporal was just coming over the roof line. Rourke caught the man in his arms against his chest before he even made it over the top.
Back down, corporal. Come on!
Rourke broke into a dead run across the parking lot, followed by the other three. The trap was about to spring, and there was too much of it to wait it out. There wasn't even time to get out of the area.
Shit! That's Folsom!
Folsom's arms were waving. He was choking, it looked like, his body doubling over, the knees buckling, but pushing himself up and forward toward them.
Come back! There is a trap!
Rourke glanced behind him. The lower roof was swarming now with Soviet troops, and the upper-level parking area was no longer nearly deserted. He could see the canvas roof lines of Soviet military trucks there. Near the lower parking area, he could make out the gleam of motorcycles.
Yes! They got all of them!
Rourke stopped running, looking up at the roof, saw a Soviet trooper, an officer beside him, jerking him around, slapping him in the face.
Lay down your weapons and you will be unharmed.
Rourke snatched the CAR-15 to his shoulder, telescoping the stock, his eye picking up the rifleman who had triggered the shot from the roof, the crosshairs of the three-power scope settling across the helmeted head. The soldier stumbled back, then fell forward over the roof line to the loading dock below. Rourke stood motionless, the rifle still shouldered, waiting. He might be done, he knew. There were too many of them. He settled the crosshairs on the officer who only a second earlier had stood beside the now dead Russian soldier.
Lay down your arms and you will not be harmed!
Rourke scanned the roofline for the man with the bullhorn, spotting him. The bullhorn shattered from the hand of the man, the white metal thing falling from sight.
Fight my ass!
The motorcyclist was closing in on Rourke. He sidestepped, and as the cyclist missed him by a good 2 feet, Rourke swung the CAR-15 from the muzzle like a baseball bat. Rourke darted for the bike, wrestling it up and mounting. The CAR-15 slung from his right shoulder and out of the way, Rourke took the bike in a wide circle as other Soviet motorcycle troopers started toward him, closing in. Looking back towards the staff car he'd seen earlier, he spotted a large man in an officer's uniform, field glasses pressed to the front of his face.
I'll give you a good show, pal.
Rourke turned off sharply to the left, heading toward the green of the grassy knoll on the far side of the lot. He hadn't done the hell-for-leather kind of hill climbing for years, he thought, his hands like vices on the bike, getting every ounce from the gears that he could as he bent low over the machine for the run toward the hill. He hit the incline, swaying his balance from side to side, his feet going out, supporting him, then pulled up. Rourke made the jump into the upper parking lot. More of the motorcycle troopers were there and trucks loaded with troops, the men spilling from them and swarming toward him. Rourke curved the bike, slowing it, firing the CAR-15 sideways across his body at them. Then letting the rifle fall on its sling to his side. He headed back toward the knoll again. There were as many as a dozen of the Soviet motorcycle troopers now starting up the knoll toward him, and Rourke cut his wheel left, veering away. But in front of him, the exit to the parking lot was blocked by trucks at the far end. A cloud of orange rolled toward him, and he glanced from side to side. Most of the Soviet troopers were wearing gas masks. He veered the bike left, a line of six Soviet cyclists coming toward him, and swung the CAR-15 back into his hand. Two of the Soviet troopers went down. Rourke bent down low over one of the dead soldiers, snatching the gas mask from the dead man's face. The orange cloud was rolling toward him, obscuring his view. He angled the bike away from it and across the parking lot, aiming toward a dozen bikers coming in single rank at speed toward him. He veered the bike left again, then back toward the knoll. Six of the Soviet motorcycle troopers were just below the lip, but Rourke couldn't stop. Rourke's face was numbed on the left side. His left arm pained him. The CAR-15 was gone from his shoulder. The gas mask was torn from his face. Rourke tried to push himself up, but he couldn't get past his knees. A dozen of the Soviet foot soldiers now rushed him. He drew the Colt Government 45 into his right hand. Rourke hammered the butt of the Colt into the face of the nearest of the Soviet troopers as his left hand snatched the M16 bayonet from his belt. Rourke staggered to his feet, the AG Russell Sting 1A in his right hand, slashing. There was a ring of men around him now and a knife in each of his hands.
You want me alive? Then pay for it!
The soldiers closed on him, Rourke's hands and arms working like pistons, driving the knife blades, slashing. Men fell, stumbling and dying around him. The bayonet was gone, stuck in somebody's chest, and he swung the Sting 1A in a wide arc, the Soviet soldiers edging away as Rourke spun in a circle with the knife outstretched, the men closing again. He rammed the knife into somebody's stomach and tried getting it out. His right arm went numb as a rifle butt crashed down on it. He snatched at the nearest man, his left hand going for the throat, his fist tightening on the front of it and crushing the windpipe, his right knee driving upward into another man's groin, his right arm still numb, swinging in front of him. Someone had him around the knees, and Rourke hammered his left fist down on a rabbit punch. The pressure around his knees relaxed, and Rourke threw his left fist forward, his knuckles splitting as he smashed out somebody's teeth, his numb right arm pushing away a snarling face inches from his left knee ramming into another man's groin. Rourke rolled, several of the soldiers still clinging to him. He tried to push himself up. A tall man hurtled at Rourke, and Rourke sprawled back. Suddenly, it was Rourke and the tall soldier. Everyone else backed away in a tight circle. The man's face was bloodied.
I cannot kill you. I beat you, though.
Try it, big boy.
Rourke edged back a step as the soldier came at him in a rush. He sidestepped, his right foot coming up, the toes smashing into the soldier's groin. The big Russian was up, his mouth bleeding heavily, his fists raised, almost like a 19th century pugilist. Rourke started for him, but the Russian's left fist smashed forward, catching Rourke on the right side of the head, the blow stunning him. The Russian dropped his guard and moved in. Rourke thought the Russian shouldn't have done that. His left foot smashed upward, the upper part of his foot connecting square into the Russian's groin. The big man's black eyes bulged, his body stumbling forward as he doubled over. Both Rourke's fists doubled together and swung down across the man's exposed neck. The soldiers ringed around Rourke, closing him in, then suddenly parted in a wave to his right. Folsom's face and shoulder were a mass of blood, but he was alive. Beside him was the man Rourke had seen with the binoculars, the officer holding a pistol in his gloved right hand, the binoculars swinging almost lazily from his neck like a tourist. The muzzle of the pistol was flush against Folsom's right temple. Rourke glared at the man.
Rourke! Stop or I fire! You understand?
You're round.